Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free. Select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3 quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
This is The Big Breakdown. A long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Around half the cases that I handle, it seems, there is at least some information that was supposed to be turned over to defense in fairness so that everyone can be on the same page, and it wasn't. And then in terms of, sometimes it's an accident, sometimes it's on purpose. The place where it really becomes a problem legally is when the evidence is material and exculpatory, meaning favorable to the defense.
And that's what we see, at least on the surface here with the Richard Allen trial, of some of the evidence that was not turned over, specifically what was brought to light. And this all happened before the attorneys for Richard Allen have now filed to appeal his conviction. And the Bridge Guy video has also been released. This is the filing right before that, where they really laid out everything in great detail with a lot of sarcasm. I have to say, it was entertaining reading that filing. It was almost like a script. As I read it verbatim, I'm like, I could have written this. So I was impressed. But it focuses here on the possible exculpatory evidence of those Rishi Davis letters that allegedly contain information, and we've seen some, that do contain information about Keegan Klein, about Ron Logan, about the alleged confession. A lot of really serious accusations that, if it's just a letter, if it's made up, could mean absolutely nothing. But these things were not turned over to the defense so they could thoroughly vet and look at them and make that determination themselves. Instead, Prosecutor McClellan thought, you know what? I'm going to do everybody a favor, and I'm just going to say right now, these are bunk. Nobody needs to see them. I'm going to save everybody the time of day. Then he put another jar of LA gear into his head. What's your thoughts on exactly how this went down? Do you think it's legit that, he just forgot?
It's always difficult to get into the motivations of a prosecutor and why they did and didn't do certain things. But one thing that's paramount here is it's not the prosecutor who gets to determine, hey, this evidence is good enough for the defense or legit enough, in my opinion. And so, yeah, we'll throw him a bone and we'll give it to him. The prosecutor doesn't get to say whether this qualifies as exculpatory evidence for the defense. It is for the defense to receive the information and review it and decide whether or not to use it at their trial. A prosecutor's unilateral opinion that, hey, I don't think this stuff is legit, or I don't think it's that helpful for defense, should not matter at all in terms of the decision about whether it needs to be turned over. It does.
I find that, yeah, I find the reaction that McClelland is given as being kind of shocking, of just, yeah, I saw it, we saw it, but we didn't think it was anything. Again, knowing that's not his job to do that. I was expecting more of a, whoops, we forgot, we didn't see it, or just something. Not, yep, I willingly didn't give it to you because I outright said no. Is this a Brady violation? I know that's what they're really looking at here. Where can this go? Where could this lead down the road here?
It sure smells like a Brady violation. For some people who might not know, a Brady violation is based on this Supreme Court case, Maryland versus Brady, where the prosecution did this exact same thing. They withheld exculpatory material, important information to the defense. And so the defense, in bringing this kind of an argument about a Brady violation, that is a primary basis on which cases are often overturned. Convictions are often undone. And so it certainly is going in the direction of Brady. What defense is going to have to show is that it was material, meaning it was important to the case, and that it was exculpatory, meaning helpful for the defense.
The problem with all of that, though, likely a lot of this needs to be argued in front of Judge Gull. Which we know where that tends to go. So as things sit, can this go anywhere else? I mean, can a different court hear this complaint if they do file this as a Brady violation and bring this further? Or is this just going to sit in the ecosystem there of Delphi where, you know, no one can do any wrong if you're on Team Delphi?
Thankfully, there should be multiple layers of review. So even if Judge Gall looks at it and, you know, she has been, in my impression, extremely biased towards the prosecution, discounting meritorious arguments from the defense. For what reason? You know, a lot of people have speculations about that. But if she denies it, then it certainly can go to an appellate level where an appellate judge would look at it and say, hey, maybe this does look like Brady stuff. This does look like it could be helpful for the defense. It shows a potential alternative suspect.
Is this a conspiracy? Is this just small town politics? People acting too big for their britches, as I remember being told as a child, and really making dumb choices, but thinking that they have the right to do it. Maybe lack of experience, lack of reps in doing their jobs. I don't know. Where, you know, it can look like there's some real nefarious stuff going on here too, but there's a pattern of it. That's what makes it weird. It's not just like a one-off where it's like, oh, well, maybe they screwed up. It's like, oh, it seems anytime anything comes up here that could be exculpatory to Richard Allen, it's, we don't need that. Push that away. We're not going to talk about this. That's what makes this really dark and weird.
Yeah, totally. And in my experience, you know, there are some smaller, sometimes rural jurisdictions that are exceptional and they do everything by the book and they're great. And there are some that play super fast and loose. And if I do something I'm not supposed to, well, who cares? Because the judge, you know, is my neighbor for a few houses down. And, you know, I'm not saying that there is overt intentional impropriety necessarily. There might be, but they're just, like you said, they're develops this ecosystem, especially in these smaller towns and jurisdictions where people bend the rules and y'all kind of know each other and folks often get away with it. But now we sort of have this spotlight, the public eye looking at this saying, hey, that doesn't seem right.
How do you lose evidence at this day and age? Look, I get it in 1988 when everything is in paper. And even then, you can be organized. That doesn't seem to be that outrightly impossible, even with a lot of information. But today, so many things are digital. I mean, it's there. It's searchable. You can find this stuff. If you get the letters, unless you just don't file them and you don't turn it digital and you like literally toss them away, how do you lose them? Because there's accusations in here of some of these Richie Davis letters, not that they didn't exist, but whoops, we lost some of them. Some key ones that like talk about Keegan Klein and some of the things he was saying. That just happens to not be around. Keegan Klein, for those of you playing along at home, the child predator who was in communication with one of the girls and had plans to meet them the day they died. Nothing to see here, though. He's just a pervy child predator. We're going to get on a completely different charge later down the road. Again, how do you lose stuff? I mean, is it easy to lose stuff? Maybe I'm completely, you know, out of my lane here for saying that, but you're in this field.
Tony, the public would be aghast at how frequently this kind of evidence is lost, how frequently stuff turns up, in a detective's drawer or in a filing cabinet that people weren't looking at or whatever. And that is wholly unacceptable. Like you said, in this modern day and age, all of these law enforcement agencies need to have procedures where they receive evidence. It is stored digitally and otherwise in a secure fashion. And everyone in the case knows about it and knows what their duties and responsibilities are with respect to turning it over. These excuses that that just doesn't cut it for me.
That seems to be a lot of it. And there, if you read the error affidavit that was filed by attorneys for Richard Allen, there's so many pieces. Anything that seems to be or could be exculpatory, they had to beg for over and over and request and request and request, and maybe they got it. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes the answer was just the simple, we can't find it, or even worse, we accidentally destroyed it. Again, another one where it's like, you did what? How did you accidentally destroy it? I don't know if this is a pattern here in this department, but when you hear that we accidentally deleted it, like we're talking about with the DVR of the interviews with key suspects early on in the investigation, it's like the first 7 days of interviews just gone. Whoops, we recorded over it. We wanted to get the new murder she wrote. Oh, wait, it's like a really old rerun, but can't get enough of that Angela. I mean, what the hell? When you have a pattern like this, is there no accountability? Because it seems like a pretty convenient excuse to use, and it's just kind of fully accepted of, that's what they did. It's gone, it's gone. There's nothing we can do about it. But there's no accountability for those folks who do the deleting.
Yeah, I mean, Angela Lansbury is compelled, but she is not a good reason to essentially record over or lose evidence. And I'm talking in jest.
If it's course, Keith but, Morrison in Dateline, I get it. But Angela, no.
I just don't think they can play dumb kind of with a straight face here. Is it so severe incompetence that something really serious should be done? Or is it something more nefarious and something really serious should be done in terms of a benefit to Richard Allen in the case? I think either way you look at it, it has to result in some kind of measure of overt fairness to Richard Allen, which has been severely lacking throughout the entire case, in my opinion.
Very much so. I mean, whether McClelland's just incompetent and really, really not detailed and bad at his job, which I guess may be the case, or this is a purposeful railroading job against Richard Allen. Either way, the effects are the same to Richard Allen. It doesn't necessarily mean what the intent was. It means anything, incompetence or ill will, still affects him the same way. At what point can we look at McClelland and go, okay, you are not qualified to handle this case. Like, you're not qualified to even do your job. So, I mean, is there a point where another court can look at this and go, okay, there needs to be a different prosecutor here because this person, they can't seem to handle the basics of their job. At worst, maybe there's something else happening. I mean, is there a path for something like that?
You know, regardless of how egregious some errors may have been, the entity that gets to decide which prosecutor is on a case, by and large, is the prosecutor's office.
Yeah.
And so a judge typically can't say, hey, you screwed this up royally. Your chief should be smart and put someone else on. I guess they could say that. But they can't force a new prosecutor on the case. Sometimes there are motions to disqualify, but those are usually where there's some kind of actual legal conflict as opposed to just alleged misconduct. Yeah, it's typically just a decision the prosecutor's office would have to make. If they're smart and if they're prudent and if they're fair, I think they could consider somebody else.
So give me an insight here as to where McClelland is on, you know, on the prosecutor's office. It does, especially when an entity investigates itself and has to make these choices, it's not usually always the best choices that are made. So is it like, is there other people in this prosecutor's office that could say, hey, Nick, maybe go take a trip to Dollywood this weekend. Here's some tickets. In fact, stay there for the next year. Go have fun. It's a lovely place. Try the chicken. And we're going to get somebody else in here to do this. What is that process like if it were to be explored? And do you think there's a chance in hell it would be explored in this case?
They could, and in my impression, they should. This kind of thing happens regularly in prosecutors' offices, and including in the one where I worked, where sometimes a prosecutor is just not the best fit for a case for various reasons. It could be they screwed the case up. It could be they got too personally attached to the case. It could be that there is something in that prosecutor's background that makes them, that compromises their objectivity in terms of decision making. And so for those reasons, prosecutors are often rotated out. There are new prosecutors that come onto cases, and especially with one that has been plagued with such allegations of misconduct, I think it'd be a smart move for the prosecutors to get somebody else on it.
We know that they are now appealing the conviction officially. Those files have just been filed. Where does it go from here with this appeal? What court does it go to? What judge is going to be seeing this? What are the next steps in the future timeline here in the case against Richard Allen?
So oftentimes there's a doctrine called exhaustion of remedies, where the defense has to go up the ladder kind of to each individual court, expressing their grievances and requesting a new trial or vacation of the conviction. Typically, that starts with Judge Gold with a motion to reconsider. We might be past that. I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. But the next stage would be the appellate court. So the state appellate court there, and then the state Supreme Court, if the appellate court does not reverse the conviction. From there, there are also habeas corpus petitions that can be filed in federal court. So like I said, there are a number of layers of review, and hopefully one of them is going to get this right.
So basically, we're looking at if it's not going to Gull first, we're going to go to state. And then if they say yes, let's play out the possibilities here. They say yes, it looks like you should be able to appeal this. Is that just the state going, Gull has to go back and review this again? Or is the state able to make a call here and say, I mean, tell me what this means?
Yeah, certainly. So the appellate court at the state level that is above Judge Gold, they could review this and say, hey, look, I think there was a Brady violation and I think a new trial is warranted. That would be the most likely remedy. A complete dismissal from an appellate court is much more rare. So if there was a new trial, then it would go down, but it would usually go back to Judge Gold, even if she was the one who made the alleged errors that the court found as grounds, or at least partial grounds, for reversal. So it goes back kind of to the drawing board. Now, it could be given to a different judge at Judge Gold's level as well.
Does that seem like insanity? I mean, you're giving it back to the same people. I mean, especially if there is violations that were like clearly, you know, in violation of the actual defense that seemed to have some sort of malice to it, to go, okay, just try this again. Let's hope he may have a different opinion this time. Is this a big flaw in our system where maybe that should be a little ironed out better?
I think there are several flaws like that. Yeah. Another similar one is where a trial happens and a defendant is convicted and they believe that the judge made a bunch of errors at trial. They have to file, usually in most jurisdictions, a motion to reconsider or something. They style it differently in different places. But they have to go back to that same judge and be like, hey, we think you screwed up on X, Y, and Z. Do you agree with us? You know, 9 times out of 10, the judge is like, no, I was right. And so it just seems like kind of a silly exercise.
Like, follow the yellow brick road. Oh, look, it's Mr. Oz again. Oh, surprised to see you here. Okay, so that state, let's say the state says, no, we think this all worked out lovely. You can go to the state Supreme Court. What's the options from there?
Totally. So state Supreme Court would be above the appellate court level, but still at the state level, and they would review it just the same. And so you get kind of another bite at the apple in that sense if your defense and the appellate court ruled against you. The state Supreme Court could absolutely impose a new trial. The state Supreme Court could dismiss the charges. Like I said, those are pretty darn rare. But if the state Supreme Court orders a new trial, well, we're going back down to the trial level, and that's likely Judge Gold.
Back to Oz! Damn it, haven't we established all the remakes of Wizard of Oz suck? Don't do it. Okay. And let's say it fails there, too, at the Supreme Court level. And it seems like all roads lead back to Gold for the most part. Habeas corpus with the federal level. What happens on that one?
Yeah, those are less often granted than like a direct appeal at the state level. So it's kind of a Hail Mary. It's kind of a last ditch effort to obtain some relief for the defense. But every now and again, they are granted. The federal court disagrees with the state court's rulings and orders a new trial. Sometimes, even when a new trial is ordered, a bond is issued pending that new trial. But in this case, with two child deaths, I don't see that happen.
Is there, I know you had mentioned, like, they could, you know, even on a state level or a state Supreme Court level, if they decide it goes back, they could say, okay, we're going to find a different judge here. But if they don't, I mean, is there any, like, direct path that they have to get this in a different atmosphere other than Gull World?
Yeah. So if defense got a new trial, they could file like a motion to recuse Judge Gold, essentially just arguing the grounds that, hey, Judge Gold was the reason for some of these errors and exhibited, in defense's opinion, substantial bias against the defense. And even if that motion is not meritorious, sometimes it's enough for a judge to be like, hey, I don't agree with any of this, and I don't think any of this is right, but to avoid the appearance of impropriety, I'll give it to someone else. That's a possibility too.
It's the problem is the person who decides that is Gull, right?
Yeah.
Again, hey, we're going to say all these things that we don't think are right about you. Will you admit to it? No. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, where do you think, in your opinion, after, you know, you've been watching this case with all of us for a long time now, where do you think this should go, and where do you think this will go? That may be two different questions.
I think an appellate court reviewing, a state appellate court reviewing the appeal, especially on the Brady violation argument, that has real traction, and that often results in reversals. And here, you know, in talking about whether it's important, well, it shows a potential alternative suspect for whom there is other corroborating evidence that they might be guilty. And on top of that, it should have been turned over, couldn't have been used by defense in the first drugs. They didn't have it. And so the most fair option is a retrial. And I think that there is at least a reasonable likelihood of Richard Allen prevailing on that ground, or at least I think that's his strongest ground of appeal.
But if we do get back to Gull, the admission of evidence in here, the admission of third-party culprits, all of these things that were denied on failed round one, what's the incentive to allow it in this time? I mean, is there any reason to think that Gull would, if it does go back to her, that she'd be like, okay, let's let that in this round?
You know, Judge Gull, as biased as any judge could be, they also don't want to get reversed. That looks bad for them.
Yeah.
That looks bad for retention. I don't know if they're elected out there, judges out there, or if they're appointed, but it's just not a good look either way. And so, and she kind of has an out, because she could be like, hey, look, I didn't think there was enough alternative suspect in the first trial, but now with these letters, hey, I didn't know about that either. That gives me enough to meet the threshold of allowing an alternative suspect. She could kind of dance around it and let it in a way that might be self-serving, but also helpful for Richard Allen.
Do you think she'd recuse herself? I mean, she obviously, it's been brought up many, many, many times, and every time the answer is no. I don't see her doing it at any point in this, but I mean, at some point, do you just get sick of it and go, hey, you know what? Obviously, y'all got your opinions. For just the sake of this, another qualified judge can handle this. I'm going to go to Dollywood too, and I'm going to enjoy the funnel cakes for a week. You know, what could happen here?
That's the thing, is that I think the smart move for her, even if she thinks she did nothing wrong, would be to say, like you said, there's another qualified judge who can handle this just the same. And even though I don't agree with any of the allegations against me, I want to preserve the integrity of this judicial process, of this judicial district, and I want to avoid the appearance of impropriety. I'm going to hand it off. I think that would be the smart move. You know, do personal feelings get in the way of making a smart move sometimes? Sure they do.
When it comes to behavioral analysis and criminal investigations, there's one thing we know for sure. Patterns don't lie, but people do. And in the Delphi murder case, the patterns of behavior, deception, and decision-making don't just raise red flags. They practically set the whole case on fire. We now have a jailhouse confession that was ignored, a prosecutor who may have buried critical evidence, and an investigation that seemed to conveniently stare away from all of the obvious suspects. All while the man now sitting in prison, Richard Allen, insists he had nothing to do with these murders, even if half of the allegations about missing evidence, investigative bias, and alternative suspects are true. Just half! In this case, it's not just about solving a crime, it's about how law enforcement handles high-pressure cases and whether tunnel vision can lead to catastrophic mistakes or even worse. So who better than to break all this down than Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, looking at the behaviors of both the suspects in this, law enforcement in this case, does this look like a legitimate investigation, or does this look more like a textbook case of tunnel vision gone wrong, or is it beyond that? Are we into new territory where this can't be tunnel vision anymore? Too many coincidences.
You know, I really wish I could put a label on it, because all I see is chaos.
Yeah.
It's really chaotic. You know, and when you can't figure, I always have a rule of thumb when approaching any kind of situation, any kind of human being, any kind of engagement where we're analyzing. If you can't figure it out and it seems really complicated, that means there's a lack of transparency someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And because human motivations are really, really simple and predictable. And that is, everyone is always seeking to act in their own best interests, so their own safety, security, and prosperity from their own point of view in their own context, which is deep empathy. If you understand that point of view from someone else's context in life, you can then predict their behavior. When you understand that life arc and you get data points from the time of their first formative years, they're in the ages of roughly 9 to 19, and you start seeing how they decision make and the choices they're making, it's following an arc, a mm-hmm. pattern. And then every decision along that pattern, they think they are acting their own best interest, including, unfortunately, in some cases where violence starts escalating, it follows that pattern. And what we've seen multiple times here that you and I keep covering and a lot of other people are covering is Richard Allen's pattern of behavior of life did not follow he committed these murders. Now, granted, he might have. They was accused of it. He was convicted of it, and he's in prison for it. But it does not follow that pattern of behavior, because the number one thing they used against him was his own confession. I want to really reiterate this a lot. Confessions derived from torture are not admissible. He was tortured.
Mm-hmm.
The way he was treated, I mean, think about the Geneva Convention. Can think about all these things we think about when it comes to torture. Guantanamo Bay. All these things, when you put someone in isolation, the psychological torture they're under, plus the fact that he had some psychological issues before that, as is reported, anything he says is, eh.
Yeah.
It's the same reason. So think about this. If you want to do a kind of compare and contrast, because some people say, well, he admitted it. Get over it. He's guilty. Yeah. Well, torture or mishandling psychological things put on you, polygraphs aren't admissible in court either.
No.
Because it's a behavior. It's a physiological response to outside stimulus that the machine is measuring no matter what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And so even polygraph examinations, truth detectors, yeah, are not admissible in court. So why should this confession? That's why we do investigations to follow the arcs of pattern. And then you have these other two individuals who fit a pattern behavior. They had contact with the subjects. There's confessions in jail. There's all these other things that follow an arc that makes sense. Not saying they're guilty or innocent, but that say we need to look here instead of someone's life that doesn't fit that arc. That's where there's weird chaos going on.
And also where we have a pattern of behavior is with law enforcement in Delphi, covering things up, lying about it. Was it the sheriff or the chief? Somebody just stepped down in the last couple of weeks because of another case they were caught lying about. And if we go back further, I'm doing a whole piece on this, on the history of Delphi and their issues, and there's a lot of them. It follows a pattern of covering things up to protect this ecosystem of certain people in there and ignoring blatant evidence, the Ron Logan evidence. There's a ton of it. We've gone over it ad nauseum. And then you have the Keegan Klein evidence. We've talked about that ad nauseum as well. Neither of them ever charged with anything. Keegan Klein is away on child porn charges, like the upstanding individual he is, but he never was charged with anything to do with Delphi, even though they were monitoring him. They were monitoring him using the username Anthony Shots, trying to catfish and solicit little girls to go meet him somewhere. He was even communicating with one of these girls to go meet him somewhere the day of the murders. And somehow, the Delphi investigators, the Delphi authorities, looked the other way. We have another one, and this is the new bombshell from this week. It is the supposed confession letters that were disseminated out by Ricky Davis, who was a cellmate with Ron Logan back in 2017, back before we had Richard Allen even on the radar. He wasn't even a suspect. He wasn't even in the mix at this moment in time. And they don't really have anybody other than a lot of interest in Ron Logan. And the FBI is saying, Ron Logan, look at this. We're going to go in and invade the house, and we're going to raid it, and we're going to get all this information. We don't know what they ever found because, well, Delphi shut that down and shut all that information down. But you have a confession allegedly from Ron Logan with information to Ricky Davis that no one else would have known, only the killer at the scene, because these things were not disseminated to the public yet, specifically the murder weapon, the box cutter. We did not learn it was a box cutter until 2024. No one did. But he was talking about it. Ricky Davis, who was in the same cell as Ron Logan, who's saying, Ron confessed to me. He has these details. He even ties in Keegan Klein into the whole situation as well. And he says, letter after letter, ignored. Nothing seen by McClelland, the prosecutor in this case. Now, when you send letters out of prison, they're scanned. They're looked at. They get into some sort of a database. One would hope that they still have evidence of this if they ever got out of the prison. And that's the first question, because the defense of Richard Allen is saying, okay, you would have had these letters, Mr. McClelland, and if you did, you did not turn them over in discovery, because that you need to do that. It's rules of discovery. And if you did not do that, you are basically hiding evidence that could very much exonerate Richard Allen. The big question is, did he have those letters? McClelland, as of this recording, has not responded yet. Simple yes, no. Do you have them? Nothing. Just skirting around the issue, not saying anything at all. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about jailhouse confessions. Obviously, this is a letter not directly from Ron Logan, but from an inmate that was next to him. How much credence do you put on something like that? Especially with a guy that says he has nothing to lose. He's not there asking for leniency on his sentence. He's even offering to wear a wire if they didn't want to look at the letters. Let me wear a wire. You can hear him tell me these things. And they said, you don't need to do that.
Yeah, so jailhouse confessions and information like that, it will always have credibility issues, obviously. Sure. But again, but it's data points. And it's congruent data points. There's so many congruent data points pointing to someone other than Richard Allen. That's why and to me, I still have highlighted right on my notes here. You know, to me, when March in 2017, when the FBI executed a search warrant on Ron Logan's property because of the probable cause that they had, that to me said a lot, because that is, it's not because it was FBI. I want to be very clear on that. It's because it's objective outsiders. You know, everyone in life needs a loving critic, because a lot of all of us, as good as I am at behavior analysis, my wife is my loving critic because she can be objective for me. If I'm emotionally attached to the outcome I'm seeking, I'm not going to be as good as I could be as I am for you, Tony.
Yeah.
You know, because I can be objective for you because I care about you, but I'm not tied to your outcome. My wife does it for me. That's why when we have critical cases like this, especially if it's going to be a small town, especially when we might know everyone, like you were saying, having someone with an objective outside optic looking in, given that insight, that's what the FBI does when they come in on most of our cases. We come in as objectivity, as a resource to give that kind of viewpoint. That's what they gave in this affidavit, in their search warrant. Ignored.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I think there's a lot of really, really messy, horrible things going on there.
And that's the pattern of behavior that we're seeing on the part of law enforcement. Ignoring obvious signs, obvious red flags that at the very least should be looked into. You don't have to think they're real, but you got to look, because they all connect to the same group of people that we're talking about here. Some of the same people whose interviews, video interviews, just happened to be taped over when the defense of Richard Allen said in the discovery process, "We'd like to see those, please." "Oh, they're gone. We lost them. We accidentally taped them over on the DVR. Whoops. Oh, and by the way, there was nothing on them. You got to trust us. There was nothing there. Nothing there at all. We have a great track record of not lying. So, of course, what we're saying is true." That's gone. These letters, we don't know where they're at right now. I'm thinking they're probably, as we're speaking, still trying to figure out what story they're going to tell of, did we lose them? Did we get them? Do we have them in our presence, but we just never even realized we had them? Or what happened here? Because this is going to take a little coordination, too, on the part of all of them, if they're going to cover this up, because we have to, number one, determine if it left the jail facility or the prison facility where he was. Did it get to McClelland? And then what happened with it after that? If he's covering this up, if he never dispersed this information, we have a very big problem here in terms of why. Why was this part not out there? But the other bigger problem is you still have Judge Gull, who is going to do the ultimate ruling on this until it gets to an appellate level.
Yeah, because Gull is still in charge of this, my faith is low right now, just because things don't seem to be adding up every time she rules on something. And so we'll see how that goes. For people, you know, paying attention to this, just do this on your own. You don't need, you know, us sitting here as any experts or anything talking about human behavior. Just do this on your own. Google the probability. Just type in the Google machine. What's the probability of a murder of two girls by someone unknown in their life?
Just that alone.
Just that alone. And then Google this. Compare that to the probability of murder of two young girls by someone who is a sex offender and has connectivity in their lives.
And you find them on their property.
And so when you just look at the law of probability, and this is what investigators do. Again, it's not like a 50-pound brain kind of thing. When you're doing an investigation, you have a lot of data points and you have to create filters. Filters help us focus in on areas that we need to spend our time on and areas we don't. So if you have three individuals that are proximity that might be potential suspects, and you just do that simple calculation, where are you going to spend your time? Well, I have a sex offender and I have someone that's also connected with the family. It's his property. And he's there. See what I mean? And then you have Richard Allen. And also you have a physical description of someone and a photograph of someone on a bridge that looks like one of the guys. That's not Richard Allen.
Nothing to see here. Nothing to see here. Move on, everybody. There's
this
nothing.
Is not 50-pound brain kind of stuff. And then when you then put all the life arcs behind these things, you just look at what matches and what doesn't match. And Richard Allen just is not a match. And if all you're hanging that on is a shell, you know, a round that might match his gun, and the fact that he confessed while being tortured,
mm-hmm.
That's a crap case.
Add that to the mix. Yeah, I love the confessed while being tortured.
I'm throwing that torture in there. That was torture.
What will it take in a case like this for something else to get involved? With the FBI to get involved in this, not even on the case itself, but I feel like they need to be walking into a public corruption investigation of some sort here, because this town has got their work cut out for them. I'm just beginning to dig further beyond this case into some other cases in this town, and oh my God, this town has issues. Their policing system has issues. There clearly is something going on here where we're going to steer the narrative however we want to do it to cover for whoever we need to do it for. And people resign and they step down and they shift this place and that place. But nobody ever really gets held accountable for it, under the law, other than when they walked away from it, when it really gets tough. What would that take? I mean, what would it take to trigger an FBI investigation into the actual town itself? Because I think that you're not going to get anything changed here. We're not going to get a legitimate investigation. We're not going to get anything as long as the same people who are there are there.
I'll tell you, one of the challenges of public corruption investigations is sources.
Yeah.
Just think back to the Alec Murdoch case, getting people to flip against the establishment in where it's so rooted so deeply, that is a big challenge. Cause you can, the number one thing the FBI does is we prosecute cases, and we do that by developing confident human sources. That's pretty much the bedrock. You're investigating a case and all the violations that we have, whether it's counterintelligence like I did, or whether it's crime, other types of crimes that the rest of the Bureau did. And we do those cases by utilizing sophisticated techniques. Sometimes those are technical, but technical we usually go to when we fail to get confident human sources. Human beings are the best sources of information for all of our investigations. They lead us down roads. They give us the nuance. They give us context. They give us everything we need for prosecution to get the data points, the forensic data points we're going to need to bolster that case. But it's always confident human sources. And so especially in a public corruption case, these people, if they have a life arc of reps of covering for each other, their own sort of wall, breaking that wall and getting someone on the inside to flip and tell us, tell the Bureau, or tell anyone outside there what's actually going on and what sheet of paper to look up, to lift up and see, and actually see how things are being done, that is the great challenge of public corruption case. And also because unfortunately, the way the government tends to work, it's like, what's the bang for the buck? What kind of remunerations, what kind of dollar amounts are tied to this? Public corruption cases are very challenging. Here's another reason why public corruption cases are challenging. So again, I don't know the dynamic of the field office of the FBI that covers this region, but this isn't just one thing they're covering. They're covering a lot of things. There's always a lot of law enforcement collaboration that goes on between federal, state, and local. And if they're working on other investigations that they need certain people for, certain resources for, they don't want to ruin a relationship here because we need a relationship here because we're doing X, Y, and Z. So you have a lot of bureaucratic gyrations that are also going on that play into that, which again, I'm not privy to. I can't imagine what a small place like Delphi would be in that mix. But when you're looking at resources at the federal and state level that might be drawn into other areas, taking a huge focus to go into Delphi might be a great challenge, especially if you don't have the ability to crack that wall.
Well, I might have some sources here. Former Carroll County Chief Deputy Michael Thomas, who sued after being demoted for questioning the Delphi investigation. If he has evidence of misconduct, that could be an interesting source. He was basically demoted and pushed away when he said, I don't think the way you're handling this is correct. You also have Ricky Davis, who we were just talking about, the inmate who claimed Ron Logan confessed and sent letters to McClellan, could potentially work with the FBI to verify that the letters were ever received, logged, or discarded. Now, the thing that Delphi officials say about him, and I always find it amusing how they use the term miserably to note the word polygraph test. They're always like, he miserably failed his polygraph test. They don't tell us when he took it, who took it, who administered it, what questions were answered. Nothing about that, like the actual facts of if it actually took place. And considering the source, it's saying he miserably failed it. I don't put a whole lot of weight on that. Could the FBI take him in and say, let's do our own polygraph on you. We got some of the best people in the country who know how to do this correctly. We're unbiased. Let's get you in for a polygraph. And if he passes that one, maybe, I know it's not, polygraphs are not admissible in court, but we're talking the investigation standpoint here of, okay, well, what was in those letters, Mr. Davis? And what can you tell us? Because he's not dead. He's still around, at least for now, until, you know, the Delphi gremlins get him. But I'm just wondering if this is true, if he has this information and we can take away that BS of Delphi saying, oh, he failed the polygraph miserably. I think there's some credibility here that could probably go somewhere. Plus you got the other officer who basically was, you know, demoted and demeaned.
Yeah, you just need a couple good investigators that are good interviewers. And even with the polygraph, you know, just think about this too. You know, everyone listening, watching, think about how many times have we seen someone saying, besides Maury Povich, the lie detector said this. The truth detector said this. We detected. No, it doesn't.
You're a dad!
Right. See, that stuff doesn't work. Yeah. What the polygraph is great for, as a great friend of mine said, it's a great prop for someone who's a fantastic interviewer. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that a great polygraph interview, the interview itself is what's admissible. It's the confession that they get because of that interview, which is admissible or not. See what I mean? So it's actually the interview itself. Using a prop of a polygraph because it might inspire someone to think that I have to tell the truth or it's showmanship a lot of times. But a great polygrapher is first and foremost the most amazing interviewer that inspires someone to feel safe, to bring their shields down so they can feel safe to share all the heinous, horrible things they did. And there's a prop of a polygraph right here.
I hope they do something. And there could be other folks out there listening in Delphi right now who may not realize the power that they have. If you're aware of anything that's gone on, if you're, you know, someone who's working, with a court official, a clerk, an administrative staff member, former employees, anything like that, who has some knowledge of things that were influenced by pressure from one side or the other, prosecutors in this case, specifically law enforcement or external figures, speak up. There's ways of contacting the FBI to do just that. Because again, this all doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's people involved in this, whether they even realized at the time they were involved in something nefarious or not. Even if something nefarious isn't happening right now, if it's just all complete, you know, horrible decision making, and we ended up doing all these bad, horrible things, and we put a guy away because we're that incompetent, still needs to be looked into, nefarious or not.
Right. 100%. You know, and it's hard to recognize because, again, I'm always the glass half full kind of guy. I'm never thinking things are nefarious. I don't think of conspiracies. I think people fall into easy groupthink.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still on the side of, unless I see data. You know, to me, this is a really great, fantastic, horrendous case of a lot of groupthink that went sideways. Again, but we do have data points that says there could be nefarious things going on. Because, I mean, how many times have we seen a lot of things going sideways because the local officials are not as up and up as they should be?
Mm-mm. No way, shape, or form.
Yep.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.